Not interested in more. Trump the drunken wrecking ball operator, and the needle that conservatives may be able to thread to social victory. It's November 17th, 2017, and this is Last Impressions, number 40, with me, Justin Katz. I'll be honest, I don't have a whole lot of audio clips for this podcast or a lot of other people's things to comment on this time around. Some weeks it just goes that way, you know. Sometimes the public conversation just drifts in directions that I don't find all that interesting. This week it's the hoopla over Roy Moore, who's a former judge running for the U.S. Senate in Alabama as a Republican. I don't have a whole lot of interest in the topic, or Al Franken for that matter. And, you know, another aspect of the same thing. I mean, to me, these are great examples of how these topics, well, good examples of how you interesting things can become uninteresting. So let's break it down. Why one might not be interested sitting in Rhode Island in Roy Moore in Alabama. First of all, he'll ultimately be chosen or not by people in a distant state. So to a great extent, it's their business. And even to the extent that it's our business up here in Rhode Island or elsewhere in the country, he's a candidate for one seat out of 100 in an institution in which that, you know, I'm not alone in not having very much faith in this institution. And he'd be one out of 100 people in it. And that's even putting aside Congress, which dilutes his importance even more. So, I mean, really what he is a stand-in for the ongoing socio-political fight. And, you know, obviously that's something I'm usually very interested in. I'm going to spend the next 20-30 minutes talking about that kind of thing and subjects under that umbrella. But the things that would be interesting in this conversation are just, well, the things that would be interesting in the Roy Moore conversation are the way areas in which it overlaps with deeper cultural debates. So, for example, questions like, how should we interact with each other, men and women? How culpable are we when social standards change quickly? So that if doing something 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, last month was okay within your local community, how harshly should the world treat you when that changes? Another interesting question is, are our interactions somehow more profound and important when they involve sex? I've said before, this, to some degree, this all just seems like almost a prudish superstition. People mistreat each other in plenty of ways that don't involve sex, that can go across within a sex, across sexes, however you want to slice it. People can be bad to each other. And we seem to have elevated this, for reasons of identity politics mainly, to some sort of status, a mysterious superstitious status. So there are a lot of interesting questions that we could take up around the whole Roy Moore controversy, whether he's the topical vessel to carry that water, I don't know. The problem is that the heat around everything associated with sex differences is so scorching right now that we can't really delve into the debate in a nuanced way. And the nuance is what makes it interesting. It's also what advances our understanding of the world. So we're not allowed to talk about that. We're elevating this issue. We're making it too scorching to be interesting. It's got to be part of the cultural battle. And I have to tell you, and this is going to be the main topic of mine in a little bit today, the progressives seem to think that this is a good issue for them. It's a good one for them to hamstring their debate opponents and to ramp up social discord. I'm not so sure. But returning to Roy Moore, I mean, what it is, it's one of these episodes that you get in, you know, public current events, public debate. It's one of these episodes where if you aren't swept into it by the sort of initial wave of interest and commentary, and then you watch everybody else who was swept away, you know, it looks kind of like a bunch of silly chaos, really. Just people wrangling, people holding one view one day and another the next, people with no standing, hypocritical people. And then the other side gets excited when there's somebody who's proven in their hypocrisy. And it just, if you're not initially into it, it's not, it just looks silly. Like everybody's missing the point. Now, I mean, being conservative and having a lot of conservative friends and in real life and on Facebook where they share things and share the other side and sometimes the conspiracy theories, you know, I can see and understand that impulse to treat this like some kind of a political setup. I mean, people I respect are talking about things like yearbook forgery and also how convenient it is that the Washington Post suddenly was able to dig up all this dirt on this guy after decades when nobody else could. Yeah, you know, those are interesting points. But honestly, it's not hard to imagine, you know, if we treat each other fairly as human beings, it's not hard to imagine, I don't know, mitigating factors that stop those from being, stop them short from conspiracy theories. I mean, the yearbook thing, maybe the note was genuine, but somebody idiotically tried to forge it to make it forge additional parts to it or something to make it look more obvious. Just dumb, you know, did a horrible job of it. And then everybody else has doubled down on that since then. Or, you know, maybe as far as the women coming forward now after decades, you know, maybe the cultural Me Too thing made them more likely to come forward. Maybe before they didn't think anybody listened to them, or maybe they didn't think much of it before. And now the whole Me Too thing has not only empowered them, so to speak, to come forward, but also, you know, they might be tempted to grab that victim mantle, you know, the golden ring of the merry-go-round right now is this victimhood thing. And so now all these people coming forward, not just with Roy Moore, but with Al Franken, with Kevin Spacey, a lot of these things might have been people. I mean, I haven't followed any of them closely enough to say, but some of these people may have had no problem with this. It might have been to them even an almost funny story. You could imagine that being the case, but now they're being redefining the memory to themselves to make themselves victims, because that's the winning argument these days. That's the prize. And that is not at all healthy. So empowerment, good. Intentional self or deliberate self-victimization, not so good. But going back to Roy Moore, the thing is, I just don't have the interest to get to the point of understanding it well enough to form an opinion on yearbook's forgery or whether women should have come forward sooner or what this all means. You know, I don't know. Sometimes the wave just passes you by. And also, I mean, honestly, I can see from a conservative and even Republican point of view, positive paths forward, no matter what happens. And frankly, that's what you want in political battles or even cultural battles, is you want to set it up like chess, where no matter what your opponent does, you've got a move, potentially a winning move. And I see that here. I mean, even to the point of if the prospect of losing the Alabama Senate seat forces congressional Republicans to kick themselves into higher gear, getting things done as that unfolds. You know, there are all kinds of ways this could turn into a good thing. And a lot of ways that it could go bad. So, you know, it's interesting, but again, it's not interesting in a way that people are discussing it or willing to discuss it, which ultimately makes it uninteresting. So the one clip I do have for this episode comes from Jonah Goldberg's new podcast called The Remnants, available on ricochet.com, probably iTunes and elsewhere. And I'll have this episode, as always, linked in the post for this podcast on theoceanstatecurrent.com. But there was one point made in the course of Jonah Goldberg's conversation with his fellow columnist, Andrew Ferguson. And the two of them were discussing how conservative friends of theirs have compromised themselves in order to be Trump supporters. And Ferguson said he finds it just frankly depressing because people he knows and has known for a long time, he knows can't believe the things they're saying are still saying them. But in the course of that conversation, Jonah told this story, and I think it raises a very, very interesting point.
You know Tevi Troy?
Yeah, yeah. So Tevi and some Jewish... Tevi's seriously Jewish. I am not seriously Jewish, but I have the most Jewish-sounding name this side of Shlomo Abramowitz. Tevi and a couple of friends of his, we would go out for drinks. This is 25 years ago, so don't hold it against them. Almost 30 years ago. And they used to play this game of who among the goys would hide us if the Nazis came? And I never liked the game, right? Even though, again, these were immature 20-somethings after a few beers. It was not a serious thing. But I never liked the game because of what it implied about America. I never thought that this could happen here and blah, 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 blah. I do not think that Donald Trump is Hitler by any stretch of the imagination. First of all, Hitler could have gotten Obamacare repealed. But
he would have had to burn down the Capitol building.
Yeah, but he could get it done, right? So no, but seriously, I think policy-wise, there's a lot of stuff that Trump has done that we can celebrate or we can endorse or that people can look to justify their support of him and all the rest, you know, from judges on down. But watching it all unfold in real time, it kind of felt like a sort of farcical Tom Wolfe dry run for what would... I mean, imagine if Donald Trump had Pat Buchanan's brain in there, which is not to say that Pat Buchanan is Hitler, but, like, I just mean a kind of let's plan this out strategic, or even Bill Clinton's brain.
If he really, really cared about stuff.
Yeah, if he actually had an ideological agenda and he actually knew how government worked, but he could still command this kind of populist loyalty, we'd be in a very different country right now.
You know, I kind of wonder about that premise there. I mean, how many of the people who voted for Trump reluctantly, like me, or those even who have gone so far as to compromise their principles on Trump's behalf, how many of those people, all of us, would actually have supported him if we'd taken him seriously or thought he'd be effective? You know, I know for me, it was the chaos of Trump that I found preferable to a Clinton presidency, not necessarily the prospect of his succeeding in what he'd talked about, or certainly succeeding in the persona that many attributed to him. You know, I have to say that I'm relieved that, you know, as the president and Congress have tried to get the chaos under control, they've tended to stagger more to the right than to the left. I thought the other direction was much more likely, which tells you the degree to which Trumpism is a bigger thing than Trump. So I'm relieved that that's happened, but I don't know that I would have necessarily gone with that vote had it even been... Well, let's put it this way. The chaos... I'm relieved the chaos has fallen more or less in the right direction, but the chaos was what I was counting on versus the threats of the authoritarian Trump, right? So I have to believe a decisive number of people would not have voted for him and would not be defending him now if it weren't chaos, but instead authoritarianism, you know, if the Nazis were really coming for Jonah Goldberg and his friends, or me for that matter. The image I was thinking of in this regard is imagine the establishment, the political establishment, as a sort of dangerous, toxic building where that people use for bad purposes, and we want to bring it down, right? There's some chance you could renovate it, but not a whole lot. Basically, you want to bring it down. Now, the fact that the only wrecking ball operator we could find, or at least get to the job site, was this kind of reckless drunk who's going to make a big mess of it and not do things carefully and might actually hurt some people in a way, but mainly bringing the building down in a messy way that we have to clean up. But the fact that we would go with that drunken wrecking ball operator doesn't mean that people would have opted for, say, the explosives expert who really seemed more interested in blowing up the whole neighborhood than a targeted explosion of the one building. You know, I think, and I still have the faith in the American people, that we would have said, you know what, we can let this toxic building simmer for a few more years, or even not have found a better wrecking ball operator to begin with, if those were the options. In a similar vein to all this, I'm starting to feel as if there's a real opportunity for conservatives to thread a major cultural needle and come out on top in a major cultural way. And you hear all the time, you know, politics is downstream from culture and culture is the important thing. And I'm starting to see, at least in terms of principles and rhetoric, an opportunity for that. And the other day I wrote a post on the Ocean State Current where I likened, you know, all the sexual harassment stuff and the whiplash of it all. I likened it it seems a lot like it, you know, when they finally now, what, 20 plus years later, start talking about how, yeah, what Bill Clinton did wasn't so good. You know, when they'll finally admit that, and it seems like there's this real rush to sneak around and take control of the sexual harassment narrative. On a current, I likened that to sort of capsizing the sexual revolution. It's falling over, and they're rushing to, well, they're helping to push it over, and in the chaos, they want to get out on top. And what came to mind for that, the image I evoked in the post, was from the Poseidon, classic 70s movie, disaster movie, The Poseidon Adventure, where a cruise ship capsizes. Gene Hackman is probably now the most notable to people now of the actors in that movie. And there's a scene where the boat's flipping over and everybody's in a ballroom. It just happened to happen, I think, at the strike of New Year's Eve, at the strike of midnight. So everybody's celebrating, and then suddenly the room starts to roll over and there are pianos falling on people. The people grab tables and suddenly they're on the roof and they have to let go and they get crushed. And that's the scene that comes to mind as all this chaos ensues. And you know, I think there's an opportunity here if we can avoid the falling pianos, because we'll find when the sexual revolution boat is actually upside down, that from our perspective, it's now right side up. It was already flipped over. This is flipping it back. And I bring that up here to elaborate based on the poll that gubernatorial candidate Alan Fung, current mayor of Cranston, he released the results of an internal poll conducted internally of the public. I was discussing it this week in my segment with John DePietro on his show, but we didn't get to details of the most important part. Now, in the general election, this poll shows Fung beating Raimondo by 41%. Now, I think it was a kind of a weighted poll toward Republicans, so you know, we'll see. We'll need more data to affirm that. It sounds plausible to me. But what's interesting is, however the respondents were weighted, right, Governor Raimondo's approval rating was disapproval rating was 49% versus 43% approval. President Trump's approval rating came out to 51% disapprove, 37 approve. So, I mean, obviously a bigger gap on the approve point side of the ledger than the disapprove side of the ledger. But if you look at disapprove, 49% for Raimondo, 51 for Trump, that's pretty close. And, you know, those aren't people, I mean, you're not talking somewhere in there. There are Republicans who disapprove of Trump and Democrats who disapprove of Raimondo. And I think that we should study this. I don't have it here to lay it out for you right now. I'm sorry about that. But we should really give this some thought to what it is, what specific things people don't like about Raimondo and don't like about Trump that cut across our classic political partisan lines. According to the Fung campaign, specifically campaign manager Andrew Vargas Vila, I think is how it's pronounced, Fung was winning 2-1 among independents and, quote, a substantial number of self-identified Democrats. So there's an interesting mix-up going on here. And my gut is telling me that there's a path emerging not only for Mayor Fung, but for Republicans and conservatives throughout Rhode Island and the country if we can find a sweet spot. I mean, we're in a strange moment. So we're in a moment where people don't like President Trump as a character, but his policies do pretty well. We're also in a moment when progressives are really pushing their party hard left, and they're forcing splits. This came up in the news recently. Joe DiLorenzo, for those who don't know, he was one of the higher ups in the state Democrat Party. He made a comment to the media about, you know, whack job progressives in the party, and then he wasn't satisfactory in his affirmation of a sexual harassment kind of an incident claimed by a progressive Democrat woman in the General Assembly here. And so he was drummed out of his role in the Democrat Party. And now I think he disaffiliated as a Democrat altogether. But he's become this sort of figure for the progressives here. So when Bob Plain of the progressive website RI Future says, you know, is promoting some candidate running for office, that DiLorenzo's named. When the progressive women get together for the state Democrat women caucus, DiLorenzo's promoted as the big scalp that they've got, their big success. So the progressives are really pushing for this division and conquering within their own party. So we've got people not liking Trump as a character, but his policies are fine. The progressives are really pushing their party to the left hard, enforcing splits. And, you know, even where the left is getting arguably its biggest traction in this whole sexual harassment thing, they, as I said, with the capsizing image, they may find that they're kind of charging into terrain that is traditionally dominated by conservatives. I mean, just look at Bill Clinton. A Republican Congress impeached him, and now progressives are pretending to agree. He should have resigned, they're saying. So we're gonna end up on this battlefield where traditionally conservatives have dominated and progressives have found themselves there unable to agree on some of the substance, like is sexual harassment bad? Like, it's kind of weird that that they would have any desire to disagree with that. But anyway, when we find ourselves in this position, in this place, we're all looking around at the new terrain and progressives are having to disclaim a lot of what they've said in the last 40 years. And conservatives are saying, hey, wait, this is our turf. Hey, we're on our home field now. What it's going to come down to, I think, is identity politics versus, let's call it, traditional prudence. So we can take for given that whatever the issue or whatever side progressives take on a question, even if they took the opposite side just last month, the left wants to control people's lives. They want to manage us. That's most easily done if they can put us into little groups, demographically or otherwise, by class or by race or by sex. Whereas the right emphasizes what individuals can do to protect themselves and those close to them. Now, the cliched, easily dismissed would be, you know, don't wear miniskirts. You know, that's the cliche. She shouldn't have been wearing those, that miniskirt. There is a reasonable version of that, which is, you know, avoid sexual predators, even if they're powerful men, you know, that kind of thing, or have some standards for your employees and your coworkers and your family members where, you know, maybe you avoid closed rooms with people who might tempt you if you're on one end or be tempted by you on the other end. You know, these are things we can do and work into our culture in a way that isn't oppressive, but rather commonsensical. Or is it commonsensible? I don't know. That one always throws me off. So that's more what the conservatives would do. Let's build this into our culture so that we protect each other and have a respect for each other as people. In that regard, conservatives will say, you know, we have to scale back the sexual revolution. So yeah, let's take the gains where they are, things like equality, and you know, not the let's not return to a cliched version of suppressing women. Although if I could tangent on this, I've been questioning that cliche, frankly. For a while now, I get a daily from the Catholic News Agency. I get a daily biography of whatever saint is being celebrated within a church that day. And, you know, an awful lot of them are women, and they aren't just doing womanly things. Like the Saint Sue wasn't made a saint because she was a great homemaker, right? I mean, these are women who were known for their writing, for their academics, for their charitable work, for Joan of Arc, who's a military. So sometimes it feels like a cliche was established inappropriately just before you became aware, say in the 1960s in my case. And sometimes you get hints of the world before that that make you think that the cliche was unfair. So I wonder if there's some of that going on. So in that regard, where conservatives take the gains of the sexual revolution, it's really just shedding a false cliche and getting back to a richer, more individualistic understanding of people and including their sex, their gender, whichever you want to use, in that assessment of people. But basically it comes down to saying, you know, let's have standards again, which, you know, means most profoundly, I think, having a strong culture of marriage by which we can socially contrast bad behavior and create, say, a context for you know, personal freedom mixed with personal discretion. So if you have a strong culture of family and marriage, that gives you a light by which to look at all of your other personal interactions and not only protect yourself by being prudent and modest for the sake of your family, but also a way to not take things so outrageously. If somebody says something to you out there in the world that is offensive or sexually suggestive, or even the Al Franken, you know, fake boob grab, and if you can run back to your family and you're strong within that context, then you're not ashamed by the world, right? Because you've got that context and you're strong in your family and people know that. So it's the person who did the thing to you. They lose power over you because you've got power via your family. So these are the ways: standards, stronger family, more true human equality. These are the things that conservatives can stand on when we get to this point of being in a place where conservatives and progressives are saying, hey, look, the sexual revolution flipped. What do we do now? Now, on the other hand, progressives, we can predict this. They'll try to give government more power. I mean, that's what they did with colleges, where they tried to strip male college students of their due process rights in the name of hysteria about sexual harassment and assault. That's the way they'll go. It'll be a top-down government. People can't be trusted to interact with each other in the workplace or in society. So government has to come in, set up rules, set up standards, and persecute the people who deserve to be persecuted. that's why I think a lot of this environment of hyped up sexual misbehavior has been fostered and promulgated. A true cynic would probably say it was done deliberately to create the landscape under which Hillary Clinton had to win the presidency. Otherwise, it would have been equated to sexual harassment to not give her the presidency. Now that she's lost, we're living with the chaos of that. That's the even more cynical view. But, you know, if we're in that landscape and we've got these two visions of how we can recover after all this chaos in our culture, you know, I have to say, I think people are afraid to speak up against progressives. You see this even in a small local thing I haven't wanted to get involved in Tiverton, one of the high school seniors for her senior project set up a gay straight alliance, which changed it to gender and sexuality alliance or something like that, in the middle school, which was somewhat controversial. And if you look on, say, a Facebook post announcing it, you'll see a lot of comments, how great it is, an affirmation. But then there are a lot of people who put angry face emojis on the post. So I think there are a lot of people who are afraid to speak up against progressives. I mean, progressives right now, they're self-righteous and they'll be very angry and belittling and attacking of people who disagree. But they've also got control over many cultural institutions, from colleges to Hollywood and so on. But it's kind of, people will start to observe that if the idea is that we need to give more control of government to moderate and take care of us in our social lives, that we're kind of giving more power to the very ideology that created our social problems to begin with. And that's an obvious and unattractive consequence of that progressive approach. I think the traditional conservative view, stripped of the cliche of, you know, patriarchy, will be have much more appeal, even in the modern context. So to put it all together in summary, with all that rambling behind us, if conservative candidates may be able to have real crossover appeal, if they can credibly, one, argue that they've got managerial competence, which is a big thing, especially in Rhode Island in the race for governor, two, be compassionate and tolerant in a way that emphasizes individual responsibility in a family context. And three, in a way that if we can credibly respect and even promote traditional values while avoiding the appearance of wanting to impose a mirror image of the left's totalitarianism. That's going to be a big one too. You can't say, okay, I'm going to let you speak, but I'm also going to make you get back in the closet if you're gay. You know, that we need to avoid that impression. And I don't think that's hard to do. So I think, I mean, outside of a specific race like the governor's race in Rhode Island, we should make this, really give this thought, all of us, and make it a habit of our thinking and how we talk about things. This is the needle we need to thread. We need to appear competent, be compassionate, and still respect and promote traditional values. I think that's where we can go. That's our opening here, to claim this ground that we're finding ourselves lunging toward, rolling toward. And, you know, a lot of it just comes down to understanding why we believe what we believe and having confidence that we're right. So if you've liked this podcast or earlier ones of mine, go on to iTunes, give it a 5-star review and all that stuff. Also, this is on ricochet.com if you're interested in conservative commentary and community. And you go there, and if you find these podcasts and like them, they get promoted through the system. if you want to leave me feedback and comments or find the links to things I've mentioned in this podcast, they'll be on post on the Ocean State Current associated with this one. And, you know, like I say every week, don't worry so much about first impressions, because you can fix them and the culture might change around them anyway. It's the last impressions that you have to be careful with, because they could stick with you for an eternity. And in those terms, God bless you. Have a wonderful week.